Ken Forrester, Executive Director at Momenta. Welcome to our Digital Thread podcast, produced by, for, and about digital industry leaders. In this series of conversations, we capture insights from the best and brightest minds in digital industry. They're executives, entrepreneurs, advisors, and other thought leaders. What they have in common is, like our team at Momenta, they are deep industry operators. We hope you find these podcasts informative, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Good day, and welcome to episode 207 of our Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. Today, I'm greatly pleased to host Matt Oberdorfer, founder and CEO at Embassy of Things, also known as EOT, a leading software company with the mission of enabling industrial enterprises to modernize and build their operational cloud historian, industrial digital twin, or industrial data lakes. Matt is a serial entrepreneur investor, having founded or advised over 15 companies, including some which have been recognized by the Innovation Quotient Award for Information Technology, the annual eWeek Excellence Award, and the Red Herring 100 North America Award. Matt is also an accomplished speaker and author of 5 books. His forthcoming book, The Trailblazer's Guide to Industrial IoT, is a comprehensive guide for energy and manufacturing digital transformation leaders, offering insights and practical advice on upgrading the OT/IT infrastructure of industrial companies to harness the power of modern artificial intelligence, machine learning, and analytics. Matt's passion includes entrepreneurship, early stage venture capital, grassroots marketing, lateral thinking, and of course, AI and ML, especially for sustainability of industrial enterprises. Matt, welcome to our Digital Thread podcast.
Hey, thanks, Ken. I'm excited to be on the show.
And we're excited to have you. It's interesting, as we were doing the pre-briefing, we were both commenting that we both played in the same space for quite a while and never have our paths crossed directly. So I'm glad we finally got the opportunity to do so on this podcast. You know, we call this the Digital Thread podcast. So, of course, the key question to begin is, what would you consider to be your digital thread? In other words, the one or more thematic threads that define your digital industry journey.
Yeah, from my perspective, I started to be an entrepreneur when I was really young. Literally, the first company I founded was when I was 17, still living with my parents. And at that time, the world was still having Microsoft DOS and Windows was just kind of starting up. And I figured out that there's a lot of programs that had been written in BASIC, a programming language that has been forgotten since then. And the world was moving towards C. And so I came up with this idea of building a cross compiler that translates automatically code written in BASIC into C. So they basically can do it once, and then suddenly you have a whole code base that you can develop, and you can basically move from kind of DOS applications to Windows application. And for me, that was the beginning of my journey there. I already learned a lot. I learned that, for instance, that my mom was really getting concerned because I have checks arriving every day in our mailbox. And she was like, what are you doing? Like, where's this money coming from? So I also learned how important support is because, you know, one time I think a software company that wrote software for doctors to do prescriptions and other stuff called me and said, hey, you know, your software that's this cross-compiling, we're compiling the BASIC into C and we have it all running, but there's some problems and we want to, you know, come in and visit your support center, which was my bedroom in my parents' house. So it was a very kind of interesting time for me to kind of get started as an entrepreneur. I learned a lot, you know, what it takes to be an entrepreneur. But for me, it was always, you know, the digital world, the way actually how it works and what the advancements are and the innovations and the opportunities were always something that drove my inspiration, my imagination. Back then, I lived in Germany. Now I live in the United States. And for me, the journey from there to where we are today really led to a whole bunch of very important experiences and forming stages, one of which is after, you know, doing my first, you know, kind of home startup, so to speak, I joined Hewlett Packard. And inside Hewlett Packard, I recommend that every entrepreneur at some point in their life should work for a really big company because you learn a lot more than you can learn in any MBA anywhere, because just the experience to be immersed in a large organization with all the dynamics, the social, political dynamics of how an organization works, what is important to the organization versus the outside world, if you can maintain a view of the outside world, is incredible. So inside Hewlett Packard, which is the company that really I'm super thankful for that moved me to the United States, one of the things that they asked me to do is to start an internal startup. And so it was a startup inside a big company, which was great. It was really focused on something new at that time, which was 2002, 2001, I think, which was called utility computing. The idea was we can actually build a cluster that you can use to rent out compute processing power and storage over the internet. It would be like a killer application. So we did this inside Hewlett Packard, and we really thought it's kind of like an idea where, you know, each of the new computers could be kind of like a printer cartridge, right? Because Hewlett Packard was really selling printers. You sell a printer once, you make money once, but if you continue to sell the cartridges and the ink, you make tons of money, right? It's a razor and razor blade principle. So we did this, we invented it, we were featured on a lot of different magazines and highlighted in shareholder meetings and whatever. But that was an extremely important experience, you know, just for my digital thread growth, if you want, because it really gave me the freedom to kind of play the entrepreneur game on a very global level. The first system that we sold was actually in Singapore to a company that was basically in a communications space. You know, that required literally me flying to Singapore and selling it. Even though I was with a big company, Hewlett Packard, the salespeople were really focused on selling printers and computers and workstations and servers. So it was an incredible experience to work for a big company. So for me, the whole entrepreneurship kind of is weaving through, if you want, my life. It always has been.
Yeah, it's pretty clear. I didn't realize the origin story for your entrepreneurship. That's quite a story to be able to tell. You're probably better known for some of your later entrepreneurial experience, having founded and scaled a number of startups, especially in nearing, I'll call it the OT space. Let me ask, what did you learn relative to founding, scaling, and exiting a startup, especially in the deep tech space?
Yeah, there are two messages. First, a message for founders in terms of if you start something in a deep tech space, what is it you want to focus on? What is the problem worth solving? Because the deep tech space is different than if you, let's say, start a new social networking platform or some sort of consumer app or whatever, right? So that's one. The other one is, how do you go about raising funds? And what should you do or not do, or what should you avoid? So in my experience, I always dreamt about, when I was in college studying computer science, that at one time, one day, I will be in Silicon Valley doing my own startup, you know, raising millions of dollars and so on and so forth. And then the day came, I did it. I actually was on Sand Hill Road, was literally, our first office was basically in the ground floor of a $1 billion venture fund. And every morning I drove up Sand Hill Road, and that's where I hired my first VP of engineering and so on and so forth. And that company was really focused on high performance computing and building clusters out of very, very kind of inexpensive pizza box supercomputing, high CPU, high memory systems. And the idea was, if we actually could kind of build them together, we could build a supercomputer out of clusters. I mean, today that's what people do, but back then there was Convex, there was Cray, there was Silicon Graphics. I actually met the Silicon Graphics CEO at some point. I'm like, hey, we are building these clusters, you know, maybe we should join forces. And I think he just kicked me out of the office or something. But, you know, ultimately that company was used by big movie studios to actually render, because you need high-performance computer to render movies. Like Finding Nemo was done on our computers, or the Spider-Man, all the CGI for the first Spider-Man movies was done on our computers. We actually had in office on Willow Road, which is really the road that leads out to now the Meta building, but there was Sun Microsystems before. We had all the movie posters in the office that was built on our computers. The high-performance computing was also usable for oil and gas, for Wall Street. So I spent a lot of time in New York. I spent a lot of time in Texas with the oil and gas companies. But the message here is, if you have a trend, let's say it's computing or AI or whatever, is focus on something that's an overlooked problem. If you do AI, do not focus in a, let's say there's ChatGPT, do not, as a founder, do not start another ChatGPT type of thing. While you could do that, while you would find investors that give you money, everybody's doing it. Everybody, their grandmother, the dog, and the flea on the dog is doing it. So you want to focus on something that everybody needs that follows that trend, right? So let's say it's some sort of support function. It's some sort of infrastructure. It's some sort of access, a REST API, some sort of thing that everybody needs that uses this trend, some overlooked problem. If you find that thing, I would, as a founder, advise you to actually do this. Secondly, if you go raise funding, go to a fund where the fund size matches what you want as an exit, right? This is my personal, you know, motto. So if you go and raise money from a $1 billion fund, you got to think about this has to be a $1 billion exit. Otherwise, you as a funder will not get money out of it, basically. Because what's happening is the venture funds, they have to basically make the money that they have to basically get an ROI on their fund size. So if you want to have a $20 million exit, or you're happy if your company sells for $50 million, go to a fund that has a $50 million fund size. If you do a $1 billion, go to that fund. But you have to be able to think about what's your exit, how much do you want to raise, and what do you think is probably the most probable outcome for your company. If you don't have a unicorn, you focus on something small, then you might want to go to a fund that actually matches that. So secondly, when you raise your first round, Series A, I'm not talking about seed rounds, get the most possible money out of the first round, Series A. And the reason for this is, as an entrepreneur, I learned this more or less sometimes the hard way, is you're in the best position, right? You have probably not that much revenue. There's a lot of promise and you set the stage for all the next rounds. So, and the investors always take 20 to 25% of your company, no matter how much money you actually raise in your first round. Let's say you get 20 million. They probably only want 20 to 25% per company. Why? Why do they not want more? It's because there should be also Series B and Series C. And so there has to be room. There has to be room for a stock pool, stock option pool for your employees, for the founders. If you as an investor demotivate everybody by taking like 50% of the company, by round two, you're done. So in terms of opportunity for you to raise funding, go and lay out a plan that really tells the story why you need that much money in Series A. That's just, again, it's my personal experience. I've been there, done that a bunch of times. So for me, these are kind of the things I learned as an entrepreneur, being in Silicon Valley, doing the Sand Hill Road journey a couple of times. So that's just about raising funds, starting the company.
Good feedback. We often advise startups to always think about the exit strategy and work backwards. And that certainly includes how much you take in each round, how many rounds you have, what the optics are of the round profile. So this is really salient advice. Let's jump to your most recent startup, Embassy of Things, which you founded in 2018. What's the origin story and value proposition for EOT?
So for EOT, the origin story behind EOT is the following. As you mentioned, Ken, you know, I've been involved in a number of startups and a lot of them were focused on the industrial space. And many of them focused on analytics, big data analytics, and AI. And what typically happens, this is the day in the life of a startup founder in this space. Let's say you have a very cool AI that can improve wind turbines or power plants or oil and gas wells or whatever, right? So you're like, oh, we have this cool AI. We can help you predict failures and you can do predictive maintenance and, or we can optimize your production and monitor it or whatever, right? So if you go and approach a big company with this, what happens, and we saw this happening over and over again, you start a POC and the POC is going to be successful and yet you never ever get anywhere. It's like there's a POC purgatory. It's POC hell. The POC hell is plastered with successful POCs for these companies. And it's classic, right? And the reason why is that when a company, when a startup goes to a big company and says, hey, we want to do this, we have this cool new stuff, they say, we need data. We need data from your plants. We need data from your power plant. We need data from a nuclear plant. We need data from your operational systems. And the operational organization in these big companies is tight and secure, and they don't let anything in and out. It's air gap from the internet. There's no access. They're like, you are not going to get our data. We can give you a thumb drive. We can FTP you some data, and then you can play around with it. And they're like, okay. So they get some data, you know, FTP, and they run it and train their machine learning models. And they're coming back to the company and says, look, we can save you 5% on your maintenance cost because we can predict this stuff. They tell a story. And at that point, you know, whoever is the executive sponsor inside the customer says, great. He shows it to the CEO. They're like, great. Let's put it in production. And then the operational organization in the big customer says, we told you already at the beginning, nobody's going to touch our systems. Nobody is going to access our operational data sources. Go away. Right? Because their job is literally, the organization is split in operators that are really responsible to make money and operate the actual asset. And then you have the business people that have a business network and an IT and, you know, all that other stuff. So it's called the OT-IT challenge, right? So ultimately, the big problem is, how do you get data from this OT operational data systems that are all air-gapped away from the internet to the IT systems and the cloud where you can do analytics and cool AI stuff, right? So for us, the origin story for EOT was, if we can build a company that solves that problem to get data from the operational side to the cloud, everybody will love us, right? Because the analytics companies, the small startups, the big startups, they need the data to actually even show that they have cool stuff, right? So they will love us. The cloud vendors will love us because they get literally billions of data values per day. That's what we're doing today. We are delivering for some of our customers is billion values per day in the cloud, where it's consumed, processed, using up cloud services. So their cloud revenues are insane, right? So they will love us. The customers will love us too, because now we have a secure way to actually get data out of the operation system. So we basically founded this company to be the plumbers, right? So if you buy a new house, it looks shiny, right? That could be your AI company that has like all the bells and whistles to make it look nice. We really building the plumbing system inside that gets the data. In this case, it would be the plumbing, would be the water into the house, so that you can sell the house in a way with plumbing and water inside. So when people actually say, oh yeah, we want to try this out and we want to live in this house, we want to buy this house, that it actually all works. So we basically built EOT as kind of a pick and shuffle play, as a software company to provide an industrial data fabric, so that you can basically build industrial digital twins, you can build industrial data lakes, you can build cloud historians. You can basically, you have the building blocks to, you know, build everything you need and then put AI and machine learning on top of it, right? So that's really where it came from. It came really from looking at, you know, what I said before. If you look at an overlooked problem, you know, that's kind of, you know, everybody's like, yeah, we just need some data. We have the cool AI stuff. Then you have found a problem worth solving. So for us, that was kind of the origin story. And we currently really focus on energy that includes renewables, oil and gas, mining, and then also manufacturing, because that's really, you know, strategically as a company where we are expanding to. And that's where we are today.
Very helpful, actually. Industrial data fabric. I like the ring of that. Tell us
One thing here real quick.
Yeah.
Go to industrialdatafabric.com. We own the domain.
There you go. As I think you said before, you're grassroots marketing and lateral thinking. So I think that's a good example of how you're bringing all that together. Let me ask, what have been some of your notable use cases and wins?
So in terms of use cases and wins, the biggest driver for industrial, you know, we see basically three real drivers. The first is, and this is classic, you know, production increase, more revenues, and cost cutting, specifically OPEX, right? So you want to have operational expenses very, very low so that the company ultimately has more profit. And the third one is net zero, really carbon footprint reduction. And that's specifically important actually in all industries and so on and so forth. One of our most notable use cases for three is BP, you know, the global company, and specifically in North America, BPX, where our software has been in production since 2020, now for 3 years, where basically the data from the SCADA systems, from the historians such as Aviva, Pi historians, and so on, which is really the backbone of operational data, has been pumping into the cloud. You can actually go to, you can Google it. This is a public use case that we did together with AWS. So all the use cases that range from reporting, monitoring, forecasting, prediction of production and operations come through that. And it basically comes into different kind of data lakes and applications. So on the operational side, we have literally engineers that use it, production engineers. And then on the business side, there are use cases that are used for just forecasting of production and stuff like that. So in terms of use cases and what the software enables and can do, we support over 400 different type of use cases that largely fall into prediction and anomaly detection, right? So specifically being able to train machine learning models and big data analytics models, our software not only gets the data from the operational side to the cloud, but it also does all the transformation and data contextualization. Because let's be honest, if you actually are data scientist, raw data from an OPC UA server is pretty much useless. Nobody really needs that data. What you do need is interpolated data that is standardized over a certain period of time, because that's the only way you can actually train reliably a machine learning model. So our software really actually not only gets the data and puts it in the cloud as like a connector, it does kind of the magic of building a metadata, a hierarchy, as well as supplying and enriching it with all the data that you need actually to just out of the box use it in an industrial data lake to train machine learning models, and then kind of take these trained machine learning models and put it back to the edge, right? We just announced TwinTalk, which is our product, the product name, you know, connecting the digital twin to the physical twin. So the twins talk to each other. So we just announced TwinTalk GPT, which is basically very different from the large language model type of GPTs. It's a time series generative pre-trained transformer model that allows you to simulate basically floating point data. In short, you can simulate oil wells, you can simulate whole industrial systems with it, but you've got to train it, right? So what I just explained is our software not only transports the data, but it actually does the transformation to be able to train a machine learning model and then take those models and use it for simulating predictive maintenance events. So for us, that was kind of the threat and origin story and the use cases where we are today.
Okay, excellent. Wow, so you guys have been very busy. Look, I know when you're not busy founding and scaling startups, you've actually managed to write 5 books. As we mentioned earlier, your forthcoming book is called The Trailblazer's Guide to Industrial IoT. Tell us, what inspired you to write the book and what is your key themes in there?
So The Trailblazer's Guide to Industrial IoT is really an answer to all the experiences over the last, I would say, 4 years, right? So first of all, The Trailblazer's Guide to Industrial IoT is not a industrial IoT book that you would normally buy where you have information about some protocols or whatever. It's a novel. It's a fable. It is largely a story that has the typical day in the life of a trailblazer, which is a person inside an industrial company who really dares to dream big of a world beyond the limitations of today. Someone who wants to really do digital transformation, someone who wants to change the world. So that person who challenges the status quo and understands what they should be and could be tomorrow has kind of the determination to do it. A trailblazer has like a second attribute, a second trait, which is a trailblazer is not just a dreamer. He's the architect of change, someone who can really operationalize their vision and bring it to life. They have the ability, they possess the ability to turn ideas into like concrete plans, developing processes, systems, and support their goals. They can motivate others, they can help them to achieve success, and they basically relentlessly pursue their goals. They're kind of like what I said earlier, they're kind of like entrepreneurs in like a large company. So that's a trailblazer. And so the book itself is a novel that starts with a trailblazer getting a message inside his corporate office to think about, do we need AI? Do we need industrial IoT? Do we need these things to achieve net zero, to achieve production increase, to achieve cost cutting, right? What do we need? How do we need it? And so he and his team basically goes through the stages that are required to really get a big company, large corporation with all the different intrinsic political like problems and dramas that have to be navigated through to actually deliver and operationalize a solution that is basically a production increase and monitoring solution, right? So back to your question, the idea was to write a book that is teaching you something about AI, teaching you something about industrial IoT, but in kind of an entertaining form and also addressing some of the main reasons why digital transformation projects and digital twin projects either fail or fizzle out, right? Because a lot of these things, there's a big corporate movement and program with program managers start off and they never get anywhere, or they fizzle out at some point, or it's a project that everybody is kind of part of, but it never really delivers anything. So this is the story. It's really the story of how do you avoid these pitfalls? How do you not fall into these traps and landmines that typically come up beyond technology, beyond AI, while really also teaching you a little bit about how AI can be used to achieve all these kind of corporate KPIs and success factors.
Sounds like a timely and relevant book. When do you expect it to be published?
It is going to be available on Amazon mid-June. Again, there's also a website, I think it's called trailblazersguide.com or something like that. So my marketing team is working on that. But yeah, so mid-June.
Okay. We will include a link for that Trailblazer site when we publish the webcast. So always in closing, I always like to ask, where do you find your personal inspiration?
For me, they're basically number one inspiration is my family, my three kids, and just living this digital world we are in. I mean, today, as I mentioned to you earlier in our pre-brief, I'm in Houston, Texas. We are at the Energy Day created by AWS, focused on oil and gas, renewable energies, and just the, how can I say that? The bustle, that what we can achieve today, the things we can do to change the world today is something that totally inspires me. I mean, it drives me, and I think we are living in one of the most exciting times that has ever been. So
I have to fully agree with you. Yeah. And you've been at the forefront of disruptive change pretty much for your whole life, your professional life. So it's an interesting place. And certainly when one talks about energy transition and Germany, your home country, you talk about disruptive change in a very short time. And it's amazing how much is happening very quickly in that regard. So fully agree with you. Well, Matt, thank you for sharing this time and insights for us today.
Thank you so much, Ken. It was great to talk to you. Happy to be on your show.
Yeah, no, and happy to finally have you. And man, it sounds like you've got a lot of great things going. I will look forward to reading your book when it comes out and certainly learning a bit more about what you're doing at Embassy of Things. So this has been Matt Oberdorfer, founder and CEO at EOT, Embassy of Things, and accomplished writer and speaker. Thank you for listening, and please join us for the next episode of our Digital Thread podcast series. We wish you a momentous day. You've been listening to the Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please check our website at momenta.one for archived versions of podcasts, as well as resources to help with your digital industry journey. Thank you for listening.